Rots at the Core. In March 1972, four young black men were arrested by a specialist pickpocket squad at Oval Underground Station in South London and charged with theft and assault of police officers. Sentenced to 2 years in prison, the case seemed straightforward and credible to the judge and jury who convicted them. But these young men were completely innocent, victims of endemic police corruption. It is the subject of a new book called Rot at the Core, The Serious Crime of a Detective Sergeant. It's by Winston True. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Winston himself, good morning to you.
Good morning. Very good morning to you as well.
Good to have you with us. Tell me a little bit about then the background to this, because 1972, not a particularly enlightened period, shall we say, of policing in London, and especially around about South London and Oval.
No, it certainly wasn't. What happened to me and three friends was that we were coming home from a meeting with another organization. We belonged to a black community organization. We got off the train at the Oval. At the top of the escalator, some men grabbed us, started shouting and pushing us, and said that we'd been nicking handbags. So we said, don't be silly, we weren't nicking any handbags. And I said, well, we're police. So I said, well, how do you know you're police? Show some ID. I said, shut up. Go over there, and then an argument started, and before long, it broke into a big fight between us, four of us, six or seven detectives. We were arrested, taken into custody, taken to the local police station, and then they started beating us, inflicting violence upon us. What they wanted us to do was to admit to, wanted me to admit to trying to pick a man, two men's pockets on the platform, and also admit to assaulting them. Exactly, they assaulted us. And they then had this unsolved crimes book where we had to admit, well, I had to admit, the whole string of thefts in the weeks before we were arrested. They gave us a good hiding during the night. I was forced to admit to crimes I didn't commit. Went to court. The crimes we were forced to admit to were found not guilty for because I had alibis for those days the police said I was out picking pockets and nicking women's handbags. But we were found guilty of the very crime the police said they saw us doing. They were the only witnesses. We had no independent witnesses. Mm. I was sent to 2 years as an innocent person.
You also, you had been involved. You got involved with was it the Fasimbas?
The Fasimbas. It was a black group, black power organization. Our job was to provide supplementary education to what in those days called West Indian children. Community services, black history classes, self-help. It was basically a self-help organization. That's what we were doing. So when the police said we were out picking pockets, we'd been nicking up. I said, don't be silly. That's completely against our philosophy. We were certainly were not doing that. Hence, we were so outraged that a fight started. Mm. They refuse to believe us.
I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? Because because in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s, you know, they didn't teach black history. They wouldn't teach history of people of color. So perhaps what you were trying to do, and because of what was happening in the States with, like, the Black Panther movement, this yeah. perhaps brought you to the attention of the authorities.
Well, the thing about it, I don't think they knew we were black activists. I think what the police were doing at the time, there was something in London called, they invented a crime called mugging. Take it to the United States, where people would be robbed, their property stolen by gangs of unknown people. The police said these were mainly black people. Well, that may well be the case, but we certainly weren't those people. So once the police had arrested us, taken us to the police station, they then found out we were black power activists. So, and then I think that may well have motivated them to try to get us to confess to a whole slew of crimes and other robberies.
How old were you, by the way, at the time that this happened?
I was just turned 21.
Right, and the other three, because was George? Was George the youngest of you of the group?
George was 19.
Right.
Omar was 20 years old. Omar was about 24. And Chris is about 23, so that's 19, 21, 23, and 24. We're all young men, all under 25. We dedicated our lives to community work. dedicate our lives to trying to improve the black community with and also education, training. We also did some martial arts to get ourselves fit, because at that time a lot of white youths were attacking black people who were walking alone on the street. So we had to basically get ourselves fit to defend ourselves. That was quite fortunate, because that training helped me to actually defend myself against those men who turned out to be policemen. They were in plain clothes. They didn't show us any ID. So only after we were arrested, they said, "Oh, by the way, we're detectives from the British Transport Police. You lot are nicked."
When did you first come across or hear the name D.S. Ridgewell then? When did he first come across on your radar, as it were?
What happened, it was in the police station. The leader was called Detective Sergeant Ridgewell. He basically took the lead in everything. He was the one that told us that we're nicked. In the police station, he took the lead in trying to get us to basically confess the crimes we didn't commit. He took the lead in everything. It was only after we were sent to Canberra Magistrates Court. Fortunately, we got bail because the police opposed bail, saying they were very serious offences. And we'd also confess, but our barrister said, "No, these are just allegations. We strongly deny those allegations." Fortunately or unfortunately, George Griffiths had his eye was swollen and bleeding, so we were able to point to this as evidence of violence against us in the police station. So it was only then in the police station we found out about Detective Sergeant Ridgewell. It was after we were in St. Bell, we found out that his modus operandi was to arrest, accuse young black people of theft. Obviously, if they didn't do it, they'd say they'd resisted. They know we didn't do it. They'd be violently arrested, taken to police station, more violence being inflicted upon them. And his modus operandi was to get people to confess to crimes they did not commit. And he I think 19 young men, 16 black men and 3 white men were basically wrongly convicted because of his corruption.
Well, this is at the time of what they called the sus laws, wasn't it, as well, where the police were allowed to stop and search without... Exactly. Yeah. What sort of effect did that have on you and the rest of your community, you know, growing up in London in the early 70s? I mean, it didn't exactly encourage community policing, I would imagine.
No, it did not at all. People were quite suspicious. What we used to do was no black person walk alone on the street at night in southeast London. We walked in groups in case anything like that happened. And if the police stopped us, we felt they're going to... in those days, they didn't have police radios. They had those call boxes on the corner. If we felt that the police were going to call for reinforcements, we'd basically run off. That was our way of coping with constant harassment. And we'd basically just take off in different directions. So that was what happened on the street. The sus law was a way of stopping you, arresting you, and taking you to the police station where other crimes will be applied to you. So the sus was just the first line of attack by the police. We were accused of this so-called crime of mugging. We weren't muggers. We were going about our ordinary business. But yes, lots of young people were innocently arrested by the sus law. Being a suspicious person, if you're standing around waiting for someone, they'd come along and say, they saw you look in this woman's handbag, they saw you eyeing up this other man here, they saw you doing this, saw you doing that. And it just takes 2 police officers to say that they saw you doing something suspicious for you to be arrested. There are no independent witnesses recalled. Nothing of that happened at all.
When it came to trial, in the run-up to the trial, you were out on bail. What was your feeling on how the trial was going to go? I mean, did you think you were going to get off? Were you expecting a custodial sentence? What were your thoughts in the run-up to the trial, during the trial itself, and then obviously when the sentences were handed down?
In the run-up to the trial, I was fearful. I was fearful. My first wife was asking me, "Are you going to go to prison?" I kept saying, "I don't know." I'd have loved to say an emphatic, "No, I'm not going to go to prison. These policemen are lying." But I kept saying, "I don't know," because what we had hanging over us was the fact that we'd signed confessions. Fortunately, the date upon which the police said we were stealing, I was stealing, picking pockets, was a date that I had an alibi for. I was signing up the labor exchange. It was January. I'd become unemployed in December before. So I was unemployed from January until March. So what had happened? I'd lost control of my life. I'd lost control. I couldn't decide anything. I had no future. My future is dependent upon the outcome of the police case. I was fearful. Although I wanted to be found not guilty, at the back of your mind, you know that other people have been fitted up by the police. And the likelihood was that you'd be sent to prison, be found guilty and sent to prison. Fortunately, I was found not guilty of the crime the police accused of doing previous to arrest, the confessions, but I was found guilty of all the things the police said they saw me doing at the Oval Underground station that night. We had no independent witnesses. One woman saw one of the men trying to strangle me and jumped in our defense. But she was discredited by the police. We're all found guilty. I tell you, I was so shocked. I couldn't even talk. I was so shocked. I couldn't even talk. My friend was so shocked. He shouted, "This is rubbish. This is rubbish. This is rubbish." That's how bad it was.
I mean, you've described it as having a hand grenade thrown into your life.
Exactly. Thank you for reminding me about that. Yes. Ridgewell threw a hand grenade into my life and blew it all up. Shattered. Pieces flew everywhere. And I've spent the last 47 years trying to gather all those pieces together. Yes, that's exactly it.
Where were you sent to, and how long did it take you to before you finally, got your freedom and then began to fight to clear your name? Because by this point, you were known as the Oval Four.
That's right. We were found guilty on the 7th of November. Was sentenced on the 8th of November. On the 9th of November, I woke up in Wormwood Scrubs Prison. And the sad thing was that the 9th of November was the birthday of my eldest son. And I said, I felt like crap. I thought, good God, it's my son's birthday today. I'm in Wormwood Scrubs Prison. We spent from November until November 1972 to March 1973 Wormwood Scrubs Prison. We then sent to a prison outside of London called Eastchurch, down the Isle of Sheppey in Kent. The sad thing was that because it was coming on to summer, that the days were long and it felt like an eternity. Those 4 months in Eastchurch felt like an eternity. We appeared at the Royal Court of Justice in July 1973. The judge, despite new evidence, that we did not commit the crimes at the Oval Underground Station. The very same woman who had intervened on my behalf when she saw one of the men trying to strangle me, because she didn't know that they were policemen either. She thought they were just white men fighting, white men gang up on some black men. She said, as far as she was concerned, she didn't see us doing anything suspicious at the Oval Underground Station. The judge decided just to cut the sentences but not quash the convictions. So I was released from prison in the last day of July 1973. I was still angry. I was very angry, but I did not commit those crimes. So from July 1973, I was still a convicted felon. So I spent the next 47 years, from 1973 until 2019, fighting to clear my name. That was a lifetime. That's how long it took me.
You describe yourself as an angry young man, but you didn't. I mean, you could have channeled that anger into violence, back into, even though you weren't before. I mean, you know, incarceration changes people. And I've, you know, the saying is, if you want to become a thief or become an offender, just spend some time, you know, at Her Majesty's pleasure because that will teach you everything you need to know. I mean, you went on and you took, was it political sciences or social sciences?
Yeah, I took a degree in social science. I started working on the youth training scheme. The thing was that part of our commitment in the facilities was to increase our education. It was education, education, education. We were followers of the great Jamaican called Marcus Garvey, and he wanted black people to educate themselves. So as a follower of Marcus Garvey, we wanted to educate ourselves. We also were followers of Malcolm X. Malcolm X was always started off rough in life as a criminal. He turned his life around. He self-educated himself. So we looked to those two people as our heroes. Angela Davis, was another very intelligent woman. We took inspiration from her. So we all want to educate ourselves. So once I came out of prison, I took all these I took sociology classes, took political classes, got myself a first degree in social science, and started working to university. I had to keep my convictions quiet because if they found out about it, I would have been sacked. In those days, they didn't have you do police checks. People recommended you to a particular job. So I kept that thing basically under my belt, as it were. But at the back of my mind, I was still fighting the conviction, doing all the research. It wasn't until 2000 when the Freedom of Information Act came in that I decided to do some research into Ridgewell's background. And I was shocked what I found, that he had been a criminal from the first day he started the British Army Police. He was stealing parcels.
That obviously is the shocks you to. I mean, you talk about the book being rotten to the core, but that must have shocked you to the core, and also the fact that this is sort of been pretty much hushed up.
Look, it was hushed up because other men who worked with Ruffo knew exactly what he was doing, but because he, as they put it, got results, he basically put people away by basically fitting them up. His bosses were quite pleased about that. So he fitted up a whole heap of people for crimes they did not commit. But his bosses were happy because month after month, people going to court, this whole weight of evidence was presented against them. They'd be found guilty and sent to prison. His bosses were pleased. The fact that the people didn't commit the crime didn't make any difference at all. Like, I don't think Ruffo actually worked out that more people being sent to prison would mean a reduction in crime on the underground. Crime continued to increase in the underground because he just arrested innocent people. He didn't arrest the villain. He didn't arrest any people who committed anything. So he was putting people away, but the crimes kept on going on. So his boss said, go on, Derek, go on. Carry on some more. So he felt good. His bosses were patting him on the back. He was even promoted. He was made detective sergeant because he worked so well. And that was his downfall, because putting more people away did not lower the amount of offences on the underground. And that was his fatal mistake.
And he was eventually jailed and sent to, I think it was Ford, which is...
Ford prison.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
What happened? He was placed to basically guard the railway from people. There was a gang of villains operating at the Bricklayers Arms in Southeast London. What Ruffo did was to basically go into partnership with them. He then used his powers as a policeman. On one Sunday, he used a police van to drive out thousands of pounds worth of goods out of Bricklayers Arms. When his bosses said, hang on a second, how is it that we sent Derek and three other detectives down there to stop the goods being stolen? And the goods aren't, the thefts weren't reducing, they were increasing. So again, Ruffo wasn't very, although he was clever on a basic level, wasn't very intellectual. He didn't work out that he had been sent in to stem the tide of thefts meant that the thefts would decrease, the thefts increased. So they sent another group of detectives, and they caught him stealing a van loads of goods from the Bricklayers Arms police, Bricklayers Arms goods depot. He was suspended, resigned. He was sent to the very same court, the Old Bay, that we were sent to. He pleaded guilty because there's no way he could say he wasn't guilty, because they found him with a van load of goods. He was given 7 years in prison with other Transport Police detectives and the local gangsters he was involved in. He was then sent to Ford prison and he died in. He was found guilty in January 1980, given 7 years. This died in Ford prison December 1982. He dropped dead from a heart attack.
Your case was overturned. I mean, incredibly, December 2019.
Exactly.
What I mean, what is it, 47 years that it took to get that justification?
Yes. It, listen, Giles, it took me that long because There's no way I could accept that I'd done something wrong when I didn't do anything wrong. I was sent to prison. So I wrote a book called Black for a Cause, when I detailed all the things I found out about Derek Ridgewell. He's sitting out of the Waterloo 4, the Stockholm 6, Arsenal 4, Tottenham Court Road 2. He arrested two Jesuit priests and said he saw them. They didn't have their frocks on. Two Africans from Rhodesia. He arrested them, and they were picking pockets. Those two men were completely shot at picking pockets. We're priests, for God's sake. Why should we be picking pockets? The judge stopped the trial, castigated Ridgewell. I said, listen, it is terrible that people can be arrested for no reason at all, and they're not being told that you're police officers. He freed the two men, awarded them costs, and castigated Ridgewell and his team, and made a complaint to the British Transport Police. Even then, they didn't do anything about Ridgewell. So yes, all that information, I contacted the Criminal Cases Review Commission, CCRC, took my case on, referred to the Court of Appeal on all the evidence against Ridgewell, his criminality against other people, his lying, his stealing, his imprisonment, everything was put before the judge. And the judge quashed our conviction. I'm telling you, I was so pleased.
And so when did you meet up with Graham Satchwell?
Well, the thing was that outside the Court of Appeal, I knew Duncan Campbell, the crime reporter from Duncan Campbell, when he worked at Time Out. I also worked as a freelance journalist at Time Out. I met Duncan Campbell outside the Court of Appeal when the case of Stephen Simmons, who was fitted up by Ridgewell. Now, Ridgewell saw in Clapham in 1975, three white men were sitting in their car listening to music. Ridgewell came up to them and told them, "You're nicked." "So nicked for what?" "For stealing mailbags." They were accused of stealing mailbags from the Clapham goods yards. Stephen saw my book, saw Ridgewell's crime, referred this case to the Court of Appeal, referred this case to the CCRC. CCRC referred this case to the Court of Appeal based on Ridgewell's criminality and conviction. He had his conviction quashed in January 2018. Outside the court, I met Duncan Campbell. He said, "You know something, Winston? I know a retired superintendent from the British Transport Police. He knows about Ridgewell." I contacted Graham Satchwell, had a chat with him. Now, the great thing is that you need to be a good person, have good connections. Graham Satchwell was researching the great train robbery which took place on the railways. He was going through some boxes of stuff. He saw this name. "It's true. I know that name." He found the original transcript of the first trial. With that, we sent it to the CCRC, that everything that took place during the trial. They looked at that, made a case for me against the police, referred it to the Court of Appeal, and I won my appeal. Since then, Graham Satchwell and I met up. He, with all the information he had about Ridgewell's activities in the British Transport Police, all the information I had about Ridgewell fitting up 19 people who were innocent, we decided to get together and write a book. Now, this is the amazing thing about this story is that a former detective of the British Transport Police teams up with a former black activist from the Black Power Movement to write a book. The link is that my father was a police sergeant in Jamaica. So that's a link. Well, we're both concerned about justice. So that's how we got together to write the book. And I'm very pleased. If I'd met Graham Satchwell, I would not have found out about those transcripts in the archives of the British Transport Police. And if I didn't find those archives, find that book in that transcript in those archives, I would not have been able to win my appeal.
And this has been something that's been at the heart of, well, worldwide attention, what with BLM and, what's been going on. I mean, it's a timely book, Winston.
Very timely. I'm hoping that people read the book and say to themselves, "Hang on a second, that happened to me as well. Let me contact the CCRC." So anybody who's come across mistreated by the Texas, former Texas Sergeant Woodrow. Read my book. If it resonates with you, contact the CCRC. The CCRC is actually, they're the only agency in London, in England, who are fighting against wrongful convictions. If you feel you've been wrongfully convicted, contact the CCRC. They did a great job in my case. They're doing a great job there. I think three other cases come to court this year, the Court of Appeal, where three people who were fitted up by Ridgewell are going to have their convictions quashed because of the information in my book. And also because our convictions were quashed. Also, Stephen Simmons' convictions were quashed. Ridgewell has ruined people's lives. He's ruined people's lives.
The book is called Rot at the Core, The Serious Crimes of a Detective Sergeant. It's by Graham Satchwell and Winston True. We've been speaking to Winston True. Winston, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, is there social media? Where can they go to find out some more information about this case?
I've got a website called Black for Records. They can contact me through that or contact me through the publishers, the History Press. The book is published by the History Press. They contact the History Press will pass their information on to me.
Okay. The book is called Rot at the Core, The Serious Crimes of Detective Sergeant. It's by Graham Satchwell and Winston True. Winston, it's been an absolute honour to speak to you today.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much.